2024, and this hearing is being held via zoom.gov. An audio recording of today's hearing will be available on the court's website, and we have one oral case on the calendar this morning. So with that, I'll go ahead and call the first case, which is A24-0272, Han versus Jungwirth. And good morning, counsel. Can everybody hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. So you'll each be given 15 minutes for argument, and then the appellant then has an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. The time clock should be visible to you if you're using gallery view in Zoom. If you can't see it, make sure to let me know and we'll give you a quick second to readjust. But I'll remind you, please, to mute your microphone when you're not speaking. And before your argument, please identify yourself and your client for the record. So with that, I'll turn it over to counsel for appellant.
Thank you and good morning, justices. My name is JC Johnston. I am the attorney for Emily Han, who is the appellant. I'm logging in from Grand Forks, North Dakota this morning. And I appreciate the Zoom appearance because I did have a sinus surgery. So if I sound funny, hopefully it's not too annoying. This case has been before the appeals court before, and the issue is the endangerment versus the best interest factors. Following the remand to the district court after the first decision, there was an opportunity for the district court judge to make some more findings. The thing that I want to point out, I think the law is pretty established. The argument is are we going on best interest factors, or are we going on an endangerment because there was a de facto change in primary residence? And looking at the Christensen factors. And so the things that I thought were important to point out, not so much the law related, but for the court to consider in the 9-month period during the school year, Mr. Jungwirth went from 40 overnights to 240 overnights, approximately, if you take the 9 months times three, not to be exact precise, but estimated. And the argument is that this isn't a change in primary residence during the school year. And so when I look at the district court's finding following the first remand, paragraph 15, the comments made by the district court are the school remains the same, the providers are the same, and the Mr. Jungwirth isn't trying to find a primary change in residence during the school year. He's not asking us for that. And so basically there has been no change because the child can go to the same providers, can go to the same school. I don't think that there was a delve into the Christensen factors by the district court because there's a lot more to consider on whether the school changes or provider changes. We've got the distance that we travel between homes. We have people that are living in the homes. We have different household routines, homework routines, after school care, meals, activities. We have how many people or other children are in the household, the sensory disorder diagnosis for the child in this case, who is an only child in one house, but not in the other house. And so for the district court just to say, well, blanket, there's no change in the school or the providers, so there's no change. I really feel that there hasn't been a deep enough analysis on this. That was all in paragraph 15 of the decision by the district court judge following remand. In paragraph 16, again, the district court goes on to say that the apportionment of time changes, but Ms. Han will still be the primary household during the school year. That's just not true. If you're going...
Just to ask you a quick question, and then you, I'd like to allow you to continue. But are you making so? Are you saying that the district court again applied the wrong legal standard? So didn't apply Christensen as it was supposed to, or are you taking issue with the way, you know, the findings that it made in balancing the Christensen factors? Like I'm wondering, are we back to where we were last time this was before the court, where it was the wrong legal standard in determining whether it's we're modifying custody or modifying parenting time? Or are we now in the realm of looking at the Christensen factors and weighing those?
Yeah, well, after I read the decision, and I think that probably the second and the third point is how I'm feeling. I feel like the district court went a little bit further, acknowledged that Christensen applied, and then went on to try to explain Christian sin. But when I read the analysis, what I read is it's not a change in primary residence because I say so. But I don't see the underlying facts that delve into everything that's changed for this child. And so I feel like we're right kind of back at the same spot. Yes, the district court did mention Christian sin. Yes, it did pick some of the factors, but the analysis under those factors just didn't really dive deep into the facts of how this change really did affect the primary household during the school year and how it did affect the child in all these collateral ways. To me, it felt like it just says it's not a change because I say it's not. And I guess the child in this case, like I said, there's a lot of things. There were a lot of facts. It was a high conflict case. The parties couldn't make decisions together. Now they have to make joint decisions. This child is traveling 22 miles a day into East Grand Forks from Grand Forks through town before and after school. How can that be not be a change from walking one block from mom's house to the school and having mom pick up? I mean, there's just so many facts that were in this case that the district court just chooses not to look at. And I feel like there was some confusion when it came down because, again, we started talking about the best interest factors. And while the best interest factors can be 50-50 and it's not a de facto change in custody because the primary, I didn't change the primary residence. Well, you can have the words in there, it's the primary residence, but if you're doing 50-50 time and it used to be 80-20, that's clearly a change by mathematical standards alone. And so that is the, go
How
ahead.
do the district court made the point that if we're looking at just the parenting time factor alone, that most of the other the schooling, the appointments, other factors have stayed the same. So if we're really looking at the change as the parenting time, then the district court, if I think this is on addendum page 52, says if that was enough, then any request for change, no matter how slight, would be a de facto change of custody if we're just looking at parenting time. So can you help me understand why this is more than just the change in parenting time, and not what other factors should the court have considered that it did not?
Yeah, well, I think that any parent, and I've raised three kids myself, school year is different than summer. School year is not as fun. You've got to get these kids in their baths, their homework. You've got all of these structured things that you have a routine and a pattern. That's what's good for them. Summer, they get to sleep in, they get to go to activities, they get to do different things. It's a difference between the structure of the two times of the year for children as they grow up. The other big issue I had in this case was this child with sensory disorder, well established throughout the case. This is a child that doesn't adapt well to different situations. It takes a while. It's upsetting. We have things like defecating in the pants. We have other reactions that aren't good for this child to be going through this volleyball of parenting time. And there was a lot of expert testimony on that that the district court seemingly ignored on the first time. And then when we appealed, some of those, excuse me, items weren't addressed because of the Christensen factors. And so I just feel like it was a generalized glossy cover of, well, if we go from 33 or 30% parenting time to 50, I'm not going to consider that a significant change. But if you look at this child, you look at mom having primary during the school year, dad having primary during the summer, the roles they had with each, the decision making, the conflicts, the difference between the homes, it really is an overarching change for this one child to experience. And I do believe that the endangerment applies when we're looking at taking that much time during the school year away from the home that this child is accustomed to being during the school year and just saying, well, overall for the whole year, it's just parenting time. I mean, as
Ms. Johnston, is there any case law about the term primary residence, any case law that would be in conflict with the district court's decision that the primary residence during the school year is still at her home. And am I correct that during the school year they basically are 50-50 parenting time, alternating weeks?
That is what the district court ordered before I appealed the first time, was week to week for this child.
So
And
during the school year, it's even, half and half. Is there any case law that says that that's inconsistent with the concept of one parent having the primary residence?
I keep going back to the Christensen one and the Christensen two, because when Christensen one came down, I actually won a case on that. And oh, that was exciting. But then, boom, it changed to two. And in there, it specifically talks about the primary residence. I don't typically see judgments up here that designate a primary household during the summer and a different one during the school year. But in this case, that's what happened. And so I feel like the de facto change, the endangerment, the primary household, I'm relying on Christensen too, where it talks about all of those issues pretty in depth and why it contrasts the difference between the best interest and the endangerment.
In Christians, in the second opinion, the Supreme Court said that increasing one parent's parenting time to 50% without more would not modify physical custody.
Right. And they do have joint physical custody, but the Emily's house has always been the primary house, with Mr. Youngworth having every other weekend and no school nights. And so that was a substantial change that would be a de facto change in the primary household during the school year.
I mean, if we, t I'm now looking, going back to the case law, if we look at that part of Christensen 2, does that, should that also guide us towards saying that increasing parenting time to 50% would not change primary residence?
Well, there was two different things. In the district court's first decision, he took out the designation of primary residence altogether, which I didn't agree with. I talked about on the first appeal. The
I'm sorry,
second,
that was in 2020 or the decree in 2018. I'm sorry.
that would have been the first time I appealed this case.
22 maybe, yeah.
Yeah, so in the underlying district court decision after that trial, where I had argued endangerment applied, he took out the language of the primary residence of the households altogether. And so then, to get to your question, I think Christensen can be kind of a little bit confusing how you read it, because it does say, hey, you can go up to 50% parenting time, and that's not considered endangerment, but it's the primary household piece that's coming in there, the primary residence. And I think that that's the distinct part of how you distinguish Christensen, is how deep you have to dive. Let's say dad had 3 out of 7 overnights during the school year every week. I mean, then 50-50 isn't that far of a change from that, but that's not what this case was. It was weekends only, to now half of the school year overnights. And to me, that is a substantial change in primary residence. And then exasperated by this child's sensory needs, the dynamics of the people in
Can I go
play.
back? Can I go back a minute? Can you explain for me? And this is an earnest question. On addendum 52, the district court says that petitioner's home remains the primary residence during the school year. But that to say remains, that seems inconsistent with what you said that in the prior order, the district court said there is no primary residence. I'm trying to understand.
Yeah, well, I think that when he went back and did the Christensen factors after the first appeal, he added that language in, now saying that he's not trying to change the primary residence.
Is there a modification of the prior order in terms of designating a primary residence? I didn't
Well,
see. I think
he aren't.
that, am I correct? The difference between what I would call the 2024 order and the 2022 order is the underlining, correct?
Correct. Correct. Yes. Yes.
I wasn't aware of a change in a designation of primary residence in 2024.
Well, there was I'd have to, and I can go back and peek at my first brief. There was some language in the original judgment that was removed concerning the designation, and whether it's included in argument rather than the judgment now, or in the decision factual part of his decision rather than the judgment piece. I can go back and clarify that when Ms. Jensen is speaking.
If you wish. I just was wondering if you know, but okay. Thank you.
Yes, yeah, I don't off the top of my head, but I will take a peek. I see that my time here is just about up.
Yeah, I have
So
one more just real quick question before we turn over to the respondent. So this talking about the change in the primary resident. Once we're talking about that, aren't we already in the change of parenting time framework? I just want to make sure I'm understanding your argument. So first is that we should have the district court should have analyzed this under a de facto modification to custody, where the Christensen factors come in. Is the primary residence issue relevant to that, or isn't that part of the standard for determining whether the change of parenting time, assuming we apply that test, applies? Does that is my question? Am I make because I feel like we're talking about the endangered the de facto physical custody change, but then talking about parenting time, and I'm wondering how where is that the parent the excuse me the primary relevant residence relevant to the first question you're asking us, and please you can respond briefly if you don't mind.
Yeah, so that's the one thing in Minnesota. You have your joint physical and legal, which judges up here say basically are titles, and then you have your primary residence. And the primary residence has this the legal definition by case law saying that this is the place where the child or the parent that's supposed to be in charge during this specified time, you know, for the routine and the daily care and control. And it's my understanding when you move or seek to change the primary residence, even if it's joint physical custody, that it is a de facto change that requires the endangerment statute. That's how I see it.
Thank you. You'll have 5 minutes for a rebuttal. All
Thank you.
right, Ms. Jensen for the respondent.
Thank you, judges. My name is Jennifer Jensen, and I represent David Youngworth, the respondent in this matter. As the court's aware, we're here on a second time on appeal for this matter. The issue before the court is whether the district court inappropriately granted an evidentiary hearing on the motion to modify parenting time. Using the factors under Minnesota statute section 518.18 instead of using the endangerment statute because the motion resulted in a de facto change in physical custody. Furthermore, whether or not the district court failed to apply the Christensen factors to that motion. Arguably, Your Honor, the amended findings that have been submitted and are before the court went into great detail on the Christensen factors. It went beyond discussing the apportionment of parenting time in this case. And with respect to the question that Judge Johnson asked on primary residence, in this case, the child had two primary residences and has always had two primary residences. The initial judge indicated that the child's primary residence during the school year would be Attorney Johnston's clients, and the primary resident for the minor child during the summer would be my client's residence. And that allowed each of them to make decisions regarding the care and control of their minor child during those different seasons. In this case, Your Honor, the court did on remand apply the appropriate legal standard. So I believe what we're looking at here is just whether or not the analysis is on point in the legal framework articulated by the district court addresses the Christensen factors in enough detail. And I would assert, Your Honor, that it does. It went through a significant number of factors, and it found that throughout the year, if we're looking just at parenting time, Mr. Youngworth had 33% of the parenting time throughout the year. And the
Ms.
court.
Jensen, can I interrupt just to ask, the work that the district court did that you're referring to, is that at addendum 50 and 51, paragraphs 16 through 19? Is that what you're referring to? Or I just want to make sure that I'm looking at the same thing that you are.
Yes, Your Honor, that would be absolutely correct. The court is correct. The underlined portion is the modifications that Judge Harbutt made to the amended findings after it was remanded. So the court started off by looking at the apportionment of parenting time between the parties, and it indicated that the respondent had throughout the whole year 33% of those overnights. The appellant would like you to look at this in a vacuum and look at the school year and the summer parenting time as separate. That simply can't be done. We have to look at this in total. This isn't even a significant jump from 33% to 50%, especially when a parent has such a large chunk of the year throughout the summer. Obviously, this isn't a case where my client has gone from simply having alternating weekends, Friday to Sunday, to alternating weeks. He's going from 33% to 50%. If he were, additionally, these parties live in different states. So if we look at the apportionment of parenting time and whether my client was seeking to change that primary residence, that's a significant factor the court would look at. My client resides in and still presently resides in East Grand Forks, Minnesota. Attorney Johnston's client resides in and still resides in the state of North Dakota. My client at no point in time made a request to change the primary residence of the minor child. His school, his providers all remained the same and they're all in North Dakota. He never asked to move the minor child to Minnesota for school-related purposes. So Ms. Hahn's residential address was always used to designate Grand Forks as his sort of home base for school and for extracurricular activities that were associated with school. Additionally, the district...
what I see as kind of the main concern that they're raising is that this change, if you just look at it as number of hours or days, then I can see your point is, going from 33 to 50 isn't giant, but it's more the disruption of being settled throughout the school year in one home and having that routine. And then you spend the summer in a different home and you can kind of settle into that versus this is one, 1 week on one in one house, 1 week in the other house, which from a matter of routine is a big change. My question is where in the district court's analysis, do you see the judge grappling with that? And to the extent that you think that it's relevant to the Christensen analysis?
I do think it's relevant, Your Honor, to the Christensen analysis. I do believe that if I recall, and again, this was obvious, the trial was several years ago at this point, so I have to dive back into the files here. But if I recall, there was very little testimony presented on the minor child's actual schedule within each home. I don't recall there being any testimony relating to bedtime, mealtime, et cetera. However, prior to this, my client was having school night parenting time. He had alternating weekends from Thursday to Monday morning. So this young child has always been used to two separate routines. So I don't think that there would be any disruption, at least in my opinion, there isn't a disruption to his daily life because he's always been used to two separate routines. And that's where the district court did talk about his age. He was six at the time that this trial took place. It was several years prior that his parents divorced, and I was not the original attorney on that. But when we handled this motion to modify parenting time in the 3-day trial in front of Judge Harbutt, the minor child was just going into his first year of school. So he didn't have a number of years under his belt to sort of establish a school time routine, and understand what it's like waking up just at mom's house Monday through Friday. So we sort of had the ability to craft a parenting plan that allowed him to build two separate routines in the separate houses. I do agree with the Judge Bentley that the district court really didn't delve into the specifics of after school pickup or what time does he get to school, what time does he leave to school. Leave to go to school. However, I don't recall, and I don't believe that within the transcript, there was information like that presented to the district court for him to include that. The court did go on beyond his age to look at his school schedule, and the court noted that he was in his first year of school, and again, described that the respondent, my client, Mr. Youngworth, was not seeking a change in the school he was set to attend. So he would be at the same school Monday through Friday, the school that he had started to attend. And he was registered to attend at the time my client brought this motion. It would also allow him to maintain friendships and social connections within that school. The district court then went on to discuss the distance between the parties' home. Now, I think it's important to note that initially, when this matter was before the previous judge, the parties lived approximately 50 miles apart. And the district court, in its initial order, indicated that it would have essentially given the parties equal parenting time at that time, but for the distance between the parties and Attorney Johnston's client's unilateral move to Grand Forks. And that was part of my client's basis in bringing his motion, is that the initial judge indicated that if he were to move within 20 miles of the minor child, it would be a material change of circumstances, allowing for a review of the parenting time. That's why he moved to East Grand Forks. He uprooted his entire business to move his life to be closer to his son, to spend half of the time with him. So at the present time, the parties live, my client testified, it's like a 20-minute drive from my client's residence to the door of his school. And if you live in any, I'm from Beulah, North Dakota, it's a very rural area. 20 minutes on a bus or in a car is nothing. And I'm sure Attorney Johnston has clients whose children spend much longer than that in a school bus or in a vehicle to get to school. So the court noted that the distance between the parties was not significant, and it wouldn't hinder the child's ability to develop friendships, socialize with classmates outside of school, and participate in extracurricular or school activities. They're essentially, the court noted, within the same community of East Grand Forks and Grand Forks. Ultimately, after making that review, the court did indicate that my client's motion to modify parenting time did not result in a de facto change in physical custody. So I do believe that the court appropriately and descriptively went through the Christensen factors that were relevant to this specific case. I understand that the Christensen factors are not exhaustive, but the court went through the ones that were relative or important to this case. Additionally, the dis
Counsel,
Yes, Your Honor.
if you don't mind, I've got a question for you.
Yes.
I am thinking about your early remarks saying that one of the your suggestions about how we should view the appellant's argument is that it's flawed in part because it's asking us to sort of dissect the changes from what the child's school year was to what the child's summer was. And I appreciate that father has always had some parenting time during the school year, but there has been, as a result of this order, a big increase in school year parenting time. And if you examine like where the child is physically during the school year, it's changed dramatically as a result of this order. And because this is a case where the judge did designate two separate primary residences, I don't know for sure how unique that is. Feel free to comment. I mean, maybe is it Perhaps it is appropriate to do what the appellant is suggesting, which is sort of break this up into did the primary residence of the child change during the school year as a result of this order? So, and feel free to tackle that however you want. I'm just curious. I'd like to see your response to the appellant's argument or hear
Yes,
it.
Judge Bratfold. First off, this is the first case where I've ever seen where there's an unequal parenting time, but two separate primary residences. But from the outset of my involvement in this case has been nothing but unique and has presented very unique legal issues that have taken a significant amount of time to address. With respect to your question, Judge Bratfold, I think then on the reverse, you could ask the question as to whether or not my client's primary residence or the child's primary residence has been disrupted or a de facto change in custody has occurred during the summer. I think that that question could be twofold, especially if you're allowing Ms. Hahn to have significantly more time in the summer than she's used to. I mean, arguably, then that's impeding on my client's parenting time with the minor child and his ability to be designated as the primary residence. I do think that it's important to go back to the sort of schedule that the minor child had, and there truly have been so many changes in this minor child's schedule since the day this divorce took place that it's difficult to articulate what his natural schedule has been. The transcript in the case will indicate that he experienced a significant amount of instability in Ms. Han's home with different moves and her having different jobs. So I think that is a main reason. There was a lack of information presented to the court on his specific schedule. I don't know that he had a specific schedule. And again, I don't think that you can just look at, and I have children too. So there are two very different schedules when you have children in the school year than children in the summer. Mine sort of run amok and they have later bedtimes to my dismay. But I think you have to look at it in total. I don't think you can look at this in two separate lenses and say, okay, there's going to be, he has this August through May, and then the end of May through the end of August is this completely separate situation. I think you need to look at each parent's schedule in that respect and determine whether or not there's going to be a significant shift from home to home. And that information was never presented to the court. There's no indication that the schedules are different or that the minor child was suffering in this case or that he was receiving an unstable schedule between the homes, or that, frankly, that he was having any difficulty with the exchanges that occurred between the homes. Again, when we went to trial on this, my client was exercising 5 out of 14 overnights with his son, and he was picking him up from school. He was dropping him off at school. He was very involved with the school and his son's education. He was ensuring that his son made it to appointments when they were on his parenting time, or that he was present for any and all therapeutic appointments when it wasn't his parenting time. So this isn't, again, a situation where an individual had just Friday to Sunday, 365 days a year on alternating weekends. This is a situation where you had two parents who were involved in, and a minor child who's always had two separate schedules at each individual home. I do see that my time is running out. So that being said, I would simply ask that the appellate court affirm the decision of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson. You have 5 minutes for
Thank
rebuttal.
you, Judge. Judge Johnson, I did go back and I did look at the first appeal, and what I was talking about would have been at Addendum 39 and 114 and 115 of the first appeal. And the language saying that John's primary residence shall be with the petitioner during the school year was removed from the first judgment. And the second judgment, or the first order that I appealed, specified the party still had joint physical custody, but then was silent as to the child's primary residence. And so that was something I talked about in the first appeal.
I'm sorry, Addendum 39 is what you cited?
And then again at addendum
Your
one.
addendum?
Yes, 114 and 115 was the second cite from my brief.
Is that the addendum in the prior appeal?
Yes, it
Okay,
was
I
at
understood.
paragraph 41 of my first appeal brief is where I talk about that.
Thank you.
Yes, and so a few things that I want to point out that Ms. Jensen has touched on. Number one, we If I remember correctly, we had a 3-day trial, the second, the evidentiary hearing that led to the first appeal. I was, again, not the attorney of record originally on this case. I came in somewhere down the road. I want to point out that a few things that were said, I feel like we're kind of delving back in time. But at that 3-day trial that we had, Mr. Youngworth was seeking 50-50. And they appointed a parent investigator, and there was a temporary order. He kept coming at her, "I want more time, I want more time, I want more time." This temporary order is what gave him the Thursday night. It was a concession by Ms. Hahn to try to resolve, give him something, resolve this. And I briefed it in the first brief. Temporary orders cannot be used against a person at trial. I mean, there's a statute on that, and that was all discussed in the first appeal. So to say that he was exercising these Thursday nights and then trying to use that to show that, oh, hey, everything was good, again, is something that you can't do under statute. It was a concession she made for a temporary period of time to try to resolve this matter, which obviously didn't work. There's talk about no evidence of disruption. There was a plethora of evidence at the evidentiary trial before the first appeal, where the OT testified, the occupational therapist, the speech therapist. We had a counselor. We had multiple people testify, and the district court seemingly disregarded a lot of that evidence. And that was, again, part of the first appeal, which wasn't addressed by the first appeal panel because they said,
I have a quick question about that. I mean, the district court, didn't the court consider that evidence in weighing the best interest factors? So again, I'm kind of trying to figure out what we're talking about, whether we just keep us focused on the question of what standard we're applying, whether it's the physical custody or the parenting time standard. And then separately, the courts did seem to consider more information, at least when analyzing the best interest of the child. And so I'm again just want to keep us focused on where that is and wonder how that's relevant to your first question about that the wrong standard, that we shouldn't have even applied that standard in the first place. So kind of keeping it, because the Christensen factors are obviously different from the best interest factors, right? So can you address that difference there and how that evidence should have been considered and wasn't in the Christensen analysis?
I can. I think that, sometimes, as in everything, the best interest factors, they can overlap. The Christensen factors, I think there's some overlap with the best interest factors as well. But, a big part of the expert testimony in this case came from the child's providers talking about which parent was that they believed was better suited to meet his best needs, which was more reluctant to get service. The level of fighting between these parents had gotten them kicked out of several providers' facilities because they were just always emailing, texting, wanting, what did the other one say? So it was a continual change in providers just by the conflict between the parents. It had nothing to do with anything the child was doing. We talk about the Christensen factors and the changes on this child. The sensory disorder was a big thing because they explained what this sensory disorder was, how the changes aren't good for a child, how adapting's not good for a child, how some of these providers saw how the stress of even exchanges between between the parents exchanging the child manifested in these negative things like defecating his pants. This
Ms.
child.
Johnston, your time has expired. Feel free to just give us a closing sentence if you'd like.
Yeah, thank you. I think that, I feel like that the district court isn't properly applying the legal standard for the primary change in home and instead just saying it's going to be this way because I say so. And I have issue with that. It greatly affects this young man. That's all I have.
Thank you, counsel, for your argument this morning. The case has been submitted, and we will issue a decision within the time prescribed by statute.
Thank you.
Thank you
Have a
very
great
much.
day.
You too.